in a way, this is one thing that We're the News wants to help with, because journalists, you know, I was talking earlier about how the news industry has changed. Journalism is going to change in a huge way, because when generative AI becomes so good that you can't tell the difference between a human and a bot, it's going to put a lot of journalists out of work.
Welcome to Tech Talks, hosted by myself, David Savage, and powered by Nash Squared.
On today's show, we're talking to Jade Torsic. Jade is the CEO and co-founder of We Are The News, a news website, a new news website. There's a lot of new there.
Yep.
Hello, Keish.
Hello.
How are you?
Very well. It's weird not seeing you on a screen.
On a screen?
Yeah, we're actually
we're in person.
We're recording.
Not on Teams.
No, no.
It's very nice. We're sitting in a little booth where our CEO would normally sit.
We're actually sat in her office, aren't we? Or her area.
It's not really, that makes it sound like it's very hierarchical and she has an office, but it's open plan.
Very true. It is open plan, but it's normally where she would, if she was in the building, you'd find herself here.
Saying that she has an office is almost fake news, which is...
That is fake news.
Which is a very good subject for today's conversation.
And if anyone from Nash Squared is listening, I can confirm she does now not have an office, so... You know, don't. I'm not spreading any vicious rumours about her.
Fake news spoiler. Yeah, we're talking about news because our guest, Jade, as I said, We Are The News, which is a news-based social... Jesus, I'm going to have to say this again. A news-based social media platform that empowers citizen journalism.
Mm.
Do you know what citizen journalism is?
I guess normal citizens writing up about topics that they want to talk about.
Yeah, so basically trying to encourage diversity of opinions and different perspectives, which...
Is that not social media?
No, but journalism.
Okay.
Basically people reporting the news that matters in their locale or, you know, without it being constrained, I suppose, by... an editor that you don't know that might have a particular slant. As we know, a lot of our media outlets are owned by people that want news to appear a certain way.
Correct.
And this is a reaction to that, trying to give something that's a little bit broader in its view and reporting on news that might appear, I suppose, more to a broader, more diverse set of tastes.
Yeah, I like
Let's say that.
Yeah. Let's listen to it.
This morning, I'm joined by Jade Torsic, the CEO and co-founder of We Are The News. How are you this morning?
Yeah, very well, thank you. How are you?
Yeah, not too bad, not too bad. Whereabouts are you joining from?
London.
Yeah? It's a nice morning looking out my window right now, so that's a positive to be recording on a nice day.
It is. Yes, it is. Yeah, especially in like the weather recently. My boiler's broken at the moment.
I've had many experiences like that in rented accommodation in London over the years. Whether it's hopefully you get it fixed, but I was probably a victim of my generation in that I rented in London for 15 years, and so when anything like that went wrong, it always felt like it took forever to get it fixed. I hope it doesn't take forever to get it fixed in your circumstances, but thank you for taking the time to log in this morning nonetheless. Before we get into anything else, who are We Are The News?
We're The News. It's a news-based social media platform. The whole idea behind it is, you know, the way that people consume the news has changed so much. So say, for example, our parents' generation, you know, they're probably still relatively clung to like the TV and the print media, although print media died a death over COVID, as you can imagine. But with each younger cohort, they're consuming the news via social media. So they're more likely to get their Instagram, you know, their news via Instagram than the Independent, say. So people are consuming news differently. And also there's record levels of distrust in the mainstream media. Rightly so, I would argue. There's a lot of bias. You even go so far as to say there's a fair bit of propaganda flying around, so people just don't trust it. And there's also record levels of news avoidance going on at the moment. So we figured it makes sense. Everyone has a smartphone now. It makes sense to kind of put the news in the hands of the people. You know, citizen journalism can become a real thing. And you're more likely to get like an accurate, nuanced picture of what's going on in the world the more people that participate. So hence... We're The News.
When you talk about citizen journalism, sorry, that's a concept that I'm not familiar with. What are we talking about there? I assume, I mean, on the basis, basically, I would assume that it's people like you and I writing a story, but that might be overly simplistic.
No, well, essentially, yes. I mean, long term, the platform has recently launched, but it's not the finished product. It's just an MVP because we're a startup. We've been self-funding. So we do what a lot of, and you can imagine, you know, you're in tech, so you know that building a platform from scratch, you know, it's very time consuming, very expensive, very resource heavy. So we've launched a kind of MVP, but we're going to relaunch new features all the time. So video will be coming soon, especially because that's what young people tend to interact with. But yeah, essentially anybody can be a journalist now, you know. Obviously, I suppose people would argue that, you know, editorial standards and people are very concerned about mis and disinformation. To that, I would say that to some extent it can't be helped, but there's also a strong argument to say that actually, you know, a lot of mis and disinformation emanates from the mainstream itself. But we would always encourage people to cite their sources, to, you know, to try and kind of put a balanced argument out there. But again, it comes back to that thing of, you know, when you think of news outlets, it seems like there's loads of choice, that there's all these different news stations and publications and so on. But actually, when you look at parent company ownership, there's only about, I don't know, six companies that pretty much dominate the whole news industry globally. So it's kind of an illusion of choice. And then also kind of logistically, let's say you're a news channel, you've got to pay sound people and camera people and all these, you know, loads of logistics and stuff. So actually, in terms of showing the news, it's kind of limited sort of spatial temporally, you know. So actually,
yeah,
everyone has a phone. So yes, there's probably going to be some duds and there's probably going to be, you know, it's going to happen. But at the same time, the more people that participate, the more of a kind of, I think we'll get more of a kind of accurate kind of, you know, because any new, as the saying goes, there's two sides to every story, right? You know, and things aren't as simple as they're often presented in the mainstream, which is like goodies, baddies, right, wrong, black, white. You know, there's a lot of grey, there's a lot of subtlety. So we figured that actually, you know, if the people kind of present the news, you know, this is what's happening outside my window, it's going to be more accurate. And it's going to represent more people, you know, and we really want to fight back against cancel culture as well. You know, because that's kind of becoming a thing. You know, I think there's a sense, I think the public can kind of sense that there's a, you know, we all have to think the same, we all have to be on board with the same ideas and notions and so on. But actually, in reality, we don't, you know. So we want to kind of bring back good old fashioned debate, you know, dialogue. Like you and I can think differently on a topic, but that's okay, isn't it? You know, we can still be friends. We can, you know, and even if we have a conversation and we walk away from it and we still think the same as we did before, we would have learned something, you know.
So you say that there's a whole load of different things that you could kind of unpack there.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, social media has been, the finger has squarely been pointed at social media as being the root evil of spreading disinformation. And, you know, if you think about the way that, that Facebook has been used by politicians on or from across the spectrum to get their message out to users, to mobilize people, whether that's from, you know, the way it was lauded for the Arab Spring or through to Donald Trump and kind of populist leaders using it to spread their messages. It's been difficult to control that. And yet here we are with a news platform proposition on social. So how do you kind of explain that to people to go, no, this can be something that's positive and doesn't fall into those traps?
Yeah, well, absolutely. And I think that, you know, when we look at social media platforms, you know, look at things like the Twitter files, for example, you know, you had or look at Facebook, you know, even Facebook's early funding, I believe, had kind of CIA kind of connections. But, you know, so there's actually kind of a lot of information coming out that governments and intelligence agencies have been leaning on social media platforms to say that, you know, you need to amplify this person or, you know, quash this story. So, you know, I would say that as much as the blame is put on the participants for kind of ramping up issues and so on, I would say there's a lot that goes on behind the scenes which shapes the conversations, you know. And of course, you know, it's very clear that Facebook's algorithms will pump up certain things because, you know, it gets more clicks and so on. But you can certainly say the same for the mainstream media. You really could, you know.
And you said people are reporting on what's outside their window. One thing that I suppose I would argue is that I am certainly not qualified to, I could have an opinion, but I'm not qualified to write a news story on something that's happening 3,000 miles away. I don't understand the complexities and whatever else, but it does seem to be that maybe if it was stuff that's happening in your local community, this almost lends itself to interesting local news reporting. Is that fair?
That is fair. But also, do you know, I'd argue, David, that actually, you know, how much do any of us know what's happening 3,000 miles away? But, you know, because somebody works for the mainstream media, you know, but they're based in London, they're not there seeing stuff firsthand, you know, how much do they know? And I think that, and actually this is kind of, you know, I feel like we need to, you know, human beings, you know, they have the capacity to learn and grow and do their own research. I'm very much an advocate of like, okay, you might not know this subject, but you can get to know it. I knew nothing about the news industry or the tech industry before I started with the news. Now I know a lot about it because, you know, I took an autodidactic approach. I learned for myself, you know. I believe that people are smarter than we give them credit for.
You mentioned before we hit record that you were keen to talk a little bit around the Online Safety Act. Mm. And I suppose elements of what we're talking about here with regards to misinformation and elements of digital literacy and understanding how to be safe online cross over. What are your views on the Act in its current form?
In its current form, it's not too bad. But how it was initially proposed, you're talking like Orwellian draconianism on steroids, you know, and it's one of those things. It's presented, you know, in this kind of wolf in sheep's clothing kind of presentation, because, you know, it's like, oh, you know, we just want to protect kids and we want to prevent terrorism. But I think it's important to remember that these acts, terrorism, you know, child abuse, all these kind of things, they have always been illegal online as they are offline. And actually, if somebody's going to be doing that activity, they're way more likely to be doing that on the dark web than they are on, you know, public social media. Of course, it happens, you know. So I would argue that actually, you know, we haven't really seen much response tackling those things from the government in general. I mean, just look at, you know, all of those files that went missing, you know, all the kind of paedophilia scandals in Parliament itself, and the files just vanished. And, you know, you had the Jimmy Savile scandal, BBC, and, you know, you had, you know, Keir Starmer was presiding over the, you know, he was the head of the Crown Prosecution Service when, you know, they decided to not prosecute Savile. So, you know, there's a lot of stuff that actually I'd argue, well, how committed are the government to child protection? Thus far, they haven't really shown that they are. But the online safety bill is kind of, it's presented as being, you know, this is amazing. But actually, one of the areas that was really contentious and it didn't get through, which thank God it didn't. However, we need to be aware of mission creep. And the thing with this stuff is, you know, you change the law, you do it in a subtle way. It's all very boring. No one's interested. So things just kind of happen in the background. And then before you know it, you wake up and it's 1984. And, you know, one of the really contentious parts of the Act was this idea of being lawful, but harmful. Mm. Harmful being poorly defined, like how do we define harm? And, you know, it's all a bit nebulous. So, and then also something that's really fascinating, this is something I would definitely, you know, ask you to look into a bit more and your viewers as well, or listeners, both, this concept of malinformation, which was literally made up, you know. So what's going to happen, just to give people, if people don't understand what the Online Safety Act is, just to give them a bit of understanding what it is. It's basically Ofcom, who previously regulated like broadcast media, so, you know, TV, you know, radio, things like that. They'll now be regulating the internet, so search engines and platforms like ourselves, which on the surface people think, oh, yeah, that's great, you know. But it's, in my opinion, and in a lot of people's opinion, it's a way of basically censoring. And, you know, freedom of speech is incredibly important. If you don't have freedom of speech, it's over. You know, it really is just, it's over. So it's so important to preserve that. So this feature of the bill or act now, because it's an act, hasn't gone through, but we need to be really, really, we need to keep our eyes peeled and make sure that it doesn't sneak in. It was this thing of, yeah, harmful, but legal but harmful. Well, if something's lawful, then you know, and then you're not defining harmful. And then they had this concept of malinformation. So there's a brilliant diagram. It's available on hang on, I'll give you the exact source. So it's the Online Harms White Paper, Full Government Response to the Consultation, Understanding Information Disorder. So I believe it was a paper that was initially published by someone called Claire Waddell, which is a lecturer. And they talk about misinformation. So misinformation would be the inadvertent spreading of false information. So this is like a diagram that people can see. Then you've got disinformation, which is the deliberate creation and dissemination of false and or manipulated information. And then there's this new made up word, which is called malinformation, which they categorize as intent to cause harm. Now, malinformation is defined as genuine information that is shared with the intent to cause harm. You know, so we're talking about genuine information here. So what springs to mind is, let's think about someone like, because people, you know, think, oh, you know, we live in the West and, you know, we have all this freedom and democracy and everything. Well, to that, I would say, well, look at Julian Assange. You know, look at WikiLeaks' accuracy record. And, you know, Julian Assange is in a real pickle now, isn't he? You know, and ultimately WikiLeaks was doing a service to the public, I think a lot of people would argue. But this new concept of malinformation, which is going to be bundled under the umbrella of mis and disinformation, would be classed as harmful. So therefore, it cannot, you know, it can be restricted from being in the public domain and categorized, even though it's not mis or disinformation, it's genuine information, by their own admission, can be categorized as such. And that is extremely worrying, because then you're talking about things that say you have a government in power. You know, I mean, you have to have a hell of a lot of trust in your government to assume that they're not going to misuse this, right? And, you know, it's how, you know, how much do you trust Rishi Sunak? Would you trust him to go and, I don't know, collect your online shopping? Probably not. You know,
I don't disagree with a lot of what you're saying. Absolutely don't. Like, and it's funny, because this is something that's been kind of, if I think back to my days at university 20 odd years ago, I was involved in the Students' Union. We protected free speech, and we wanted to get various different speakers to the university. But there was a case where there were one or two speakers who were no platformed because of their message. And there comes that point where it's like, okay, free speech is incredibly important, but if someone is promoting dangerous ideas and hate speech, that can obviously cause you to go, well, where's the line? I think it becomes increasingly complex with the advent of social media and anyone having this incredibly powerful tool in their hands to be able to broadcast views to a much wider audience. How do you intend to try and make sure that your platform, if it's anyone can write the news, that there are those safeguards around there to make sure that it's free, it's correct information, but at the same time it's positive in a sense of it can be critical, it can be questioning, but it's not necessarily leading to something more subversive?
Well, I mean, we have terms of service, you know, and those, you know, so say, for example, we talk about things like inciting violence, hatred, that kind of thing. Those are all kind of against the law. So our terms of service reflect that. And that's one of the things that Ofcom, you know, that as it stands now, the Online Safety Act, you know, although it's kind of still sort of being defined to some extent, you know, does say that, you know, you have to enforce your terms of service, and that's a biggie, you know, so that would be part of our terms of service. So obviously if somebody's breaking our terms of service, then things would be done. But with regard to kind of silencing people and cancelling people, where possible, we won't be doing that, you know, because it's important that people have freedom of expression. And I think if you don't like what somebody's saying, you don't listen, right? Or better still, you interact with them, try and change their mind, because all that you're doing, if you kind of say, okay, right, shut up, cancel you, you know, that's it, you know, and, you know, potentially ruin someone's life, you're not really helping the cause much, because that person isn't going to go off and, you know, change their views. And, you know, whereas actually if you interact with them, you have a conversation with them, then you're likely to kind of, I think, get further than if you sort of push things underground. Then things do become subversive, because things go underground and you don't know what's going on. And, you know, so yeah, I would argue that, yes, we have our terms of service. It won't be perfect. Things will slip through the net the same way that, you know, look at Facebook, Twitter, everything. They're massive companies. Things always do slip through the net. But with regard to mis and disinformation, I would say that we're not the arbiters of truth, you know. Mm. So it's not for me to decide what is true and what is not true. You know, I can have my own educated guess and I can look at the evidence and facts and I can make my own decisions, but it's not for me to force that onto other users. And this is a massive problem, I would say, with platforms like Facebook and so on, is that they, you know, they'll decide that this is false and this, you know, and there's, I can think of countless examples where they've done that. And, you know, that hasn't been the case, you know, so it's not for us to do that, I would say. You know, it comes back to that thing, I think, of respecting people's autonomy, not infantilizing people, not, you know, closing people's eyes. Well, you can't see this and you can't see that, because, you know, no, people can make their own choices. They can decide what they interact with, you know, and I would hope that they would interact with views that they disagree with the aim to hopefully change people's minds, you know.
Obviously, AI is being spoken about left, right and centre across tech at the moment. That does present a problem with regards to people being able to generate stuff that's just fabricated. How concerned are you, given the industry that you're choosing to work in, how concerned are you with the advent of AI and how it needs to be regulated?
Biggie. That's a big question. I think it does need to be regulated. I think we need to be mindful of the people that are calling for regulation are the ones that will be ultimately probably owning it. I'm quite skeptical about people like Elon Musk, for example. You know, I think that it is a concern, but, you know, it stretches beyond social media. I mean, there's a recent example, I believe it's Sports Illustrated, I think, who recently, I think, were kind of accused of creating articles that were generative AI, you know, and they had kind of generative AI avatars and all sorts of stuff. So this was, again, mainstream publication was doing that. And actually, in a way, this is one thing that We're the News wants to help with, because journalists, you know, I was talking earlier about how the news industry has changed. Journalism is going to change in a huge way, because when generative AI becomes so good that you can't tell the difference between a human and a bot, it's going to put a lot of journalists out of work. You know, and that's where we want to offer, you know, work to real people, you know, real people that, you know, can produce journalism and they get paid directly by their audience and they build a relationship with their own audience. So, yes, AI is a massive, massive issue. It does need to be regulated. How we go about that, I'm not the person to answer that question. I wouldn't know where to start.
You mentioned there that, you know, the need for journalists. You need content creators, writers for your platform.
Yes, we really do. Because, yeah, it's not perfect. Look, guys, if you go on it, don't be expecting Facebook levels of slickness. You know, we are a startup. We've been self-funding, you know, so it's a work in progress. But, yes, we really, really want writers. And coming back to your thing earlier about mis and disinformation, what we've been doing thus far is most of the content on the site is from university students, actually. So we've been partnering with like Goldsmiths and Royal Holloway, Loughborough, City Lit recently, and then various other unis that come via Handshake, which is this cool platform where students can just kind of, yeah, you can kind of have a direct relationship with them. And the reason why we've kind of reached out to university students at the outset is because, A, they're kind of used to writing, you know, they're not frightened of writing, but also because they're university students, they're used to citing their sources. They're used to not just saying things willy-nilly, you know, they're kind of putting things out there and they're referencing things properly. Now, of course, we want a more diverse pool of opinions, you know, and younger people as well. Generally, university students are younger, so that this, they get it. They understand. That's how they consume news anyway. So, but we are looking for a wider pool of, you know, writers, more diversity. We want diversity of people, diversity of thought. So, yeah, if there's anyone out there that, you know, wants to do some writing, please do so.
And look, as a founder, as someone, you know, who's trying to build a tech startup, what would your one piece of advice be to other entrepreneurs from your journey so far?
I would say don't be put off by people that will try to put you off. would be my piece of advice. Because, you know, when I started this initially, people were like, yeah, it's a great idea, but, you know, what do you know about tech? What do you know about news? Can you code? You know, these were all the things that were being thrown at me. But actually, I think if you've got a good idea, be it tech or in anything, you know, and you have passion for it, you can really make things happen. You know, we've been using, we've got everything off the ground with minimal money. You know, we've been using the slicing pie equity model, which is absolutely fantastic. So if there's anyone that's looking to make a startup out there, slicing pie is a brilliant, brilliant model to get going. So, you know, I can't code. That's not how my brain is wired. You know, my background, I'm a psychotherapist. So it's completely far removed from kind of what my training is, what my work history is. But I've surrounded myself with amazing developers. You know, I've got my co-founder, Craig. He's like a seasoned developer. I've got my lead engineer, Kelton, who is just like details man. He's so focused and structured, it's unbelievable. And then I've got two amazing developers, Philip and Anushka. Then I've got Neil, who's, you know, he's like GDPR expert. You know, he's done all of our, he's done our terms of service, for example, you know, and all our admin and paperwork. Yeah. You know, he's basically a lawyer, so he's been fantastic. So we've got, you know, we've got Toyosi doing our UI UX, we've got David Mann, our CFO, who's, you know, who's very, very seasoned in finance. So we've got like a really amazing team of people that know what they're doing. So the fact is, I don't have to know everything. I don't need to necessarily know about finance and development, but you surround yourself with people that do know.
It's been a pleasure to speak to you this morning. Thanks for taking some time, and good luck as you try and get those content writers and build the platform.
Yeah, thank you very much, David. Lovely to meet you. Take care. Enjoy the rest of your day.
When you hear things like cancel culture,
yep,
and you know, Ofcom and regulation and misinformation,
yeah,
it is a bit of a moral minefield to know exactly how much regulation is the right amount of regulation. Like,
yeah,
we need regulation, we need stuff like the Online Safety,
yeah,
Act.
Yeah.
But at the same time, you can kind of understand where Jade's coming from, because she talks about the fact that if it's too draconian, it's counterproductive.
Mm-hmm. And I kind of agree with that.
Yeah?
Yeah, because I think with cancel culture, you can have an avalanche effect off someone saying a particular thing or talking about a particular subject, but that might not necessarily define everything about, do you know what I mean?
Like, yes, it's a weird one, because I hear the phrase cancel culture and I immediately have this kind of, people who talk about, maybe it's been hijacked, but I associate people talking about cancel culture with things like GB News and quite right-wing platforms.
Yeah.
And I'll be perfectly honest, that doesn't sit easily with me.
Mm-hmm.
So I've come to associate cancel culture with an aspect of news reporting that I don't like,
okay,
and don't associate with.
Yeah.
But then Jade's saying that it's a problem because it's become a thing where everyone has to think the same and be on board with the same ideas and notions. So what she wants to do and what We Are The News wants to do is fight against cancel culture to bring back old-fashioned debate where people can think differently on a topic and still be friends, which is, I suppose, agreeably disagreeing, which is a little bit like, do you know, what's it called? The Rest Is Politics.
Yeah.
With Alistair Campbell and Rory Stewart. Yeah. Their whole thing is like, they can disagree but be friends. But
yeah, and also, I don't know, I really like that, because I think we're in an age now, we're in the workplace, right?
Yeah.
And to a certain extent, we are all expected to behave the same, have the same opinions, or at least show that we have the same opinions on a lot of things, I feel, right, at work about certain things.
Right.
Right? But if that platform's allowing people to have their own opinions, may not be what the general consensus is, as long as they're not abusive or, you know, sexist or racist or something like that, then, yeah, people are allowed to say something different. That's the whole point of an opinion, right? I feel like
we have got to the point where it's difficult to
go against the grain and then not be seen as a bad guy or a bad girl.
I think it's even more that it's almost harder for us to have a conversation with people that we disagree with.
Yeah.
And it becomes shocking when you find out that someone you work closely with has a view that you don't have yourself.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
And maybe that wasn't the case 20, 30 years ago. I'm not entirely sure.
Because I don't think 20, 30 years ago, I don't think people felt passionate about certain things. I think it was the whole... I mean, my parents used to say this thing about, you know, just let it go, just let it slip, you know, just don't worry about it. Whereas I think now, we're at an age now where everyone worries about everything all the time.
Yeah, I agree with you. And I think your parents are probably right.
Yeah.
People get too angry.
Yeah, yeah.
Too impassioned.
Exactly. And if I'm honest, a platform where people can give their opinions and takes on things and, you know, some old school debate and journalism can be back, then yeah, I think it's fun to read.
Now, thinking about citizen journalism, I'm going to be doing a bit of citizen journalism next week.
What are you doing?
I'm going to be in Rio.
Again?
Well, you say again. It was a year ago that was last in Rio.
Yeah. Wow.
Going to be talking about what's going on in the tech sector in Brazil.
Lovely. Web Summit?
Web Summit Rio.
Like it. Okay.
So we'll be getting some news from the Latin American startup ecosystem, definitely. Yeah. And anything that you'd like me to try and kind of turn attention to?
I mean, I'd love to find out what their stances on AI on that side of the world. And because we read about it a lot, right? We just talked about deepfakes, talk about all this stuff. But I'd love to see what that region...
Why, they have a different attitude towards
it? Yeah.
I'd be surprised if they do, but maybe I'm being naive.
Yeah. I'd love to see, because I'd love to see what different cultures make of it. So,
if it's less cautionary, a bit more kind of open. Yeah.
Bit more openry and, you know, well, let's just play with this and see what happens.
Maybe, I don't know.
Yeah, so that'll be interesting. Anyway, enjoy.
Yes. Late flight on Sunday. But if you're out there, if you're heading out to Web Summit Rio and you're listening, drop us a DM.
Yep.
We'll be looking to create some content. I'm going to try and record a podcast using this Nomono sound capsule on the beach.
Lovely. And when you say we, you mean you, because I'm not going. I'll be here.
Yeah, but London's one of the greatest cities in the world, Akish.
I'll be here in London.
There's no little violin, because,
you
know...
No, that's fine. I'm not beach bod ready yet, so, you know.
maybe with a deep fake, you would be.
Oh, yeah, correct, yeah. Unfortunately, they can't talk. They can only be seen. But anyway, hopefully one day, yeah.
We will be back on Friday.
Tech Talks is hosted and edited by David Savage. It is produced by Nash Squared. And we have special thanks to Lemzy for supplying music to this show.